Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Children today are growing up anxious. How parents play a role in that anxiety and alleviating that anxiety is the topic today. Joining us now by phone to talk about that is co-author of The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives, Ned Johnson. Ned is also the founder and president of Prep Matters. That's a leading tutoring and test prep service. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What do we mean by self-driven?
What we mean by self-driven is a kid who has a motivational system that's not based on external drives. I'm not doing it for someone else's approval. I'm not doing someone else's drive. I'm not doing it because I feel pressured, but it's a motivation system where the kid's doing it because he wants to do it, and it's not based out of fear or coercion.
I mean, was there a time in our history when that was the norm anyway?
Well, I think so. You know, and it's still the case today for kids for a lot of things. I mean, you know, when we're doing hobbies or music or things that we do simply because we enjoy doing that. And if we're lucky, we have jobs that were like that as well. But certainly for kids today, it feels more and more like that what other people think about them matters more than what they think about themselves. And certainly there's been a huge uptick and this basically narcissism. The Gene Twenge is kind of the guru on this. There's been this big uptick of this really since the proliferation and ubiquity of cell phones, smartphones especially, and social media, where it really matters more what other people think about me than what I think about myself.
Right. And what does that have to do with having control over one's life?
Well, so the science shows that feeling a low sense of control is about as bad as it gets. We reference a woman named Sonia Lupien, who is this great model for what's stressful, and it's nuts. What makes people nuts? So N is novelty, U is unpredictability, T is a threat, and S is a low sense of control. And we can handle all these other stressors if we feel like there's something we can do. There's some way we can manage this. You know, feeling if your kid is sick and there's nothing that you can do about it. I mean, it's just you can't think straight. You certainly can't pay attention to your job. And then also from a motivational perspective, if you feel that you don't get to make choices, that you don't have any input, that what you do doesn't make any difference, it's almost impossible to be intrinsically motivated. And so kids today live in worlds where they feel less and less control, certainly than they did a decade ago. This writer Gene Twenge looks at this personality inventory. They started with stuff in the 30s, and they find that kids today are more stressed than people were during the height of the Great Depression, or during the Second World War, during the Cold War, or during the Vietnam War. And of course, there are many fewer stresses today. We're living in the safest time in probably human history. But kids, again, feel more stressed than they did during those what we know to be very stressful times. And so we're trying to figure out kind of what's going on with this. And the concept is there's what's called an internal locus of control or an external locus of control. And we feel better when we feel that we control when the power is within our hands. And when it's outside of our hands, it's just really, really hard on a human nervous system.
And this is a learned thing. This isn't and we've learned so much from brain scans about how it actually is affecting the wiring in their brains.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, you know, we're making the point that the most important work of childhood and more so adolescence is wiring the brain that you're going to have for the rest of your life. And we don't want kids growing up chronically stressed, chronically underrested, chronically unhappy. We want them to have a motivational system where they're well-rested, where they're stress-tolerant, and where they feel excited to do things rather than doing it because they're avoiding stressors. In our book, we talk about the research done by a guy named Michael Meany, and it's really neat. They take these what are called rat pups, or the baby rats, and from the day that they're born, they take these pups away from mom, and then these lab technicians kind of handle them with these latex gloves for about a half an hour, and it's really distressing to these pups. But if they put them back in the cage with mom, and mom is what's called a high licking and grooming rat, which is kind of the rat equivalent of there of hugs and kisses, the stress of the rat just kind of, the cortisol, the stress just flows right out of them. And then you do this back and forth. They stress them, they put them back. They get, and the rats kind of, pups kind of go from, oh my goodness, to, oh thank goodness, it's terrible, it's mom, it's terrible, it's mom.
Yeah.
And when they did this, it wires the brains of these pups. They created an entire line of what the research called, researchers called California laid back rats. They were almost impossible to stress out as adult rats, because their thinking part of their brains, the prefrontal cortex, all those executive functions, had the sense that whatever it is that's going poorly, you know, hashtag I've got this, it's going to be okay, because it always had been okay. And what we're wanting to see is that kids, we don't want to have kids never have any struggles. We want to let them face the struggles with support. But so often as parents, as helicopter parents, we kind of try to remove any obstacles, anything that could be hard for them. Oh my gosh, that's a mistake. And then by being overly anxious or hypervigilant ourselves, we do a subpar job of being what we describe as non-anxious presence, kind of high licking and grooming mom and dad, and says, no, it's going to be okay. You're going to be fine. And I love you. And I'm here for you. So the kids face the stressors themselves, but then come home, where home is a safe base, rather than, you know, I get this all the time for kids who don't do well on a test, and they're really upset. And then the first thing that pops in their head is, oh my gosh, and my dad's going to kill him. My mom's going to be so upset. And now they're worrying about other people's reactions to their bad day rather than just their bad day. And so we want parents to be nurturing, supportive, but not, you know, on top of them or more concerned than their kids are.
And not be trying to end or, you know, protect him and be calling the teacher ahead of time saying, you know, you got to be easy on my kid with this test. He doesn't test well, that kind of a thing. I mean, there's a couple ways. There's different approaches to this, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, and what you're talking about there's positive stress, which is basically, you know, you're excited for that soccer game. You know, you're kind of butterflies about giving a speech, you know, and you're nervous, but you're excited. And that's where we want people to be. That's really kind of the almost a state of flow. There's tolerable stress. These are not happy things. You know, you don't make the soccer team. You get a bad grade. Your boyfriend breaks up with you. You get in a fight with your best friend, blah, blah, blah. The teacher's mean to you. But these are not this is not toxic stress.
Mm-hmm.
Parents need to step in when it's something that's completely overwhelming to a kid, and that's our job as mom or dad to say, I'm going to help. I'm going to take care of this. But the challenge is, as parents, because we don't ever want to see our kids upset, and all this is done out of love, but because we don't want our kids to be upset, we tend to step in and try to solve for them mm-hmm. things that are actually tolerable. And the better model is to be mom or dad, to be a consultant. So how can I help? May make a suggestion. Would you like some support here?
Mm-hmm.
But not step in and not call the teacher. You know, if the kid is capable of talking to the teacher himself.
There's this question of whether parents are managers or consultants, and you use
right.
that word consultants. Some parents right. probably don't feel comfortable conceding that much control to their kids. So how much does this, I mean, kids, you know, we're talking kids from the age of, say, 3,
right.
the age of reason, supposedly, to
right.
to 18 or 25. I mean, right? Psychologically,
right.
they say
right.
that you're not really an adult until 25 or whatever. But
right.
this role as consultant, that means different things at different ages, right?
Well, it certainly does, it's a great point about, you know, age 25. What we're talking about is the prefrontal cortex, and this is the part of the brain that lies right behind your forehead. And in the prefrontal cortex is responsible for what we describe, what scientists call executive functions. So it's the ability to plan and to organize, to think about the future, to take perspective, to motivate yourself. This is important, and self-control, along with emotional and mental flexibility. And so children at age 3 and 4 have tantrums, have meltdowns in ways that it would be pretty shocking if a 24-year-old did that,
mm-hmm.
right? And part of it is, as we get older, we have more of cognitive and mental control and emotional control. So what we're really talking about is the wiring of that part of the brain to be able to handle situations and really to be able to manage the other parts of our brain. The threat detector in your brain is this thing called the amygdala, and when it goes off, when we freak out, the thinking part of our brains go bye-bye. So what we're talking about is the healthy development of executive functions in the prefrontal cortex, so the kids become more grown-up like and they can handle things well. The challenge is that we as parents, we know that our thoughts, our reactions, you know, how we might do this is more sophisticated than what our kids would do because they're still children. But we want to give kids every opportunity to handle things by themselves as much as they can because it's wiring this brain and really hastening the healthy development of that brain. Now, we don't let a three-year-old run the household, right? You might give them choices. So do you want to wear this shirt or that shirt? You know, mm-hmm. Do you want this vegetable today or that vegetable today? Do you want to do a bath time before dinner or after dinner? But we don't give kids things that are beyond their ability to control, in part because it's overwhelming. You know, parents are the authority, and they should remain the authority, but within the prescribed boundaries, you try to give kids more and more responsibility, in part because it makes them more stress tolerant, more resilient, and it increases their motivation, right? So it's pretty darn important stuff, and particularly when you get to adolescence, you want to give them as much as possible. You want to tell them it's going to be your call for anything that matters about their life because we want to watch them make decisions while we're around to watch them. Well, I don't want to have a kid who hasn't made any real decisions for himself and then send him off to some distant university with a whole bunch of my money with no evidence that he's done things by himself that, you know, he's going to be back home, you know, but both of our pockets will be empty. And we don't want to do that. You know, in my experience, and certainly in Bill's experience, and you know, again, I work with, you know, super, super academic, kind of really driven kids. Oftentimes, I have to peel them off the walls because mm-hmm. they're so intense. Bill's work is oftentimes with kids where things aren't easy. You know, they have all kinds of challenges that makes learning harder. But for both of us, one of the best things you can say to a kid at any age, but particularly to teenagers, is that I know you have a brain in your head, and I know you want to be successful. I know you want your life to work out. And when we treat kids just the opposite, they will so often, particularly teenagers, because they just get so mad and they want to be in charge of their own lives, we see kids repeatedly do things that are against their own best interest just because they're mad. And if we kind of step back and sort of take the sail out of the kid's wind, right, say, I'm not going to fight with you about this, you know, but I really want to talk through this, you know. You get so much better buy-in, and you just get a better outcome.
You know, we started this conversation. You said that we live in a safer world than ever before, but I don't feel like kids feel like they're safer than ever before.
You're right. You're right.
I think the marches regarding, you know, in memory of the 17 dead mm-hmm. at the Parkland High School shooting is testament to that.
Well, no, you're absolutely right, and that is, I mean, unquestionably. I mean, you know, 50 years ago, if some kid or adult had a real problem and walked into a school and shot up a couple local kids, and I live on the East Coast and that happened on the West Coast, the chance that I would know about that was almost zero. Right, but television today and all the media, you know, has it allows me to know about every bad thing that happened anywhere, and we all know this. We all complain about this watching, you know, CNN. Is that it isn't, you know, a constant, you know, 24-hour feed of all the wonderful things in the world, of people treating their neighbors nicely, mm-hmm. and boy, a kid came home, had a wonderful dinner with mom and dad. We don't hear about that. Mm-hmm. We hear about all the bad things, and so our perspective is very much slanted. And also, when people are anxious, they have a natural inclination to pay attention and to keenly pay attention to things that could be threatening. And so when people are stressed out, they pay more and more attention to the stressful things, which makes them more stressed and more likely to pay attention to the stressful things. And we get this really, really bad feedback loop. So it's hard. I mean, for me, you know, I read a few things online, but I'm just not living my life, you know, glued to my cell phone, waiting for the next bad thing to happen, because I've read too much science and know how that really will not be conducive to my health, happiness, and well-being. And the concern that we have with kids, they don't know a world without this. You know, the world that they experience feels a whole lot more stressful than what you and I grew up with, but they don't know a different world.
You're listening to Ned Johnson. He's founder and president of Prep Matters. That's a leading to tutoring and test prep service. He also is co-author with William Stixrud of the new book entitled The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how parents can learn to trust their kids' choices and the benefits of giving them more freedom to make those choices. Still with us is founder and president of Prep Matters, that's a tutoring and test prep service, and co-author of The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives, Ned Johnson. And joining us also as well by phone is clinical neuropsychologist and co-author of the same book, William Stixrud. Welcome, William.
Hi.
As a clinical neuropsychologist, what are you seeing in the makeup of kids' brains that wasn't there in previous generations? I mean, it's kind of hard to compare, right? Because we don't have scans from generations past.
Yeah, exactly. But we can infer, though, that because there's this brilliant research that's compared the self-reports of adolescents and young adults on the same psychological measure since the 1930s. And people, young adults and adolescents in the early 2000s were 5 to 8 times more likely to report symptoms of anxiety and depression than people did at the height of the Great Depression or in World War II or during the Cold War. And we can infer from that, because anxiety and depression are stress-related problems, they're disorders of stress regulation, that the stress response systems look different in young people today than they did 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 20 years ago.
Does this mean we've raised a couple generations of kids who, what does it mean going forward for our country, for the society, that we have this couple batches of kids coming out that have a hard time making decisions?
Well, you know, the person who did this brilliant research, tracking these symptoms across generations, mm-hmm. also looked at internal versus external locus of control. And in Ned's book and in my book, it's about how important it is for kids to have a sense of control over their own lives. And over the same period of time, as people got more anxious and less happy, as young people did, their sense of control became more external, less internal, more, I'm basically, why bother trying? There's so many things I can't control that my life, my choices don't make that much difference. And so we think that we got a crisis on our hands here, and we think that the current level, the rate at which anxiety and depression are increasing, is not sustainable. And I talked to 4 people yesterday who said their high school kids were doing 6 hours of homework at night,
it's simply
not sustainable.
You know,
we think. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I was going to say, as I was reading the book, I had taken my puppy to puppy class. And people say, well, what's your puppy learning? I said, well, it's not really about the puppy. It's what I'm learning. And as I'm reading your book, I think this really isn't about what the kids, about kids. This is about the parents.
Well, we figure it's so counterintuitive because Ned and I see all kinds of really parents who are really anxious about their kids. And it's counterintuitive to think that one of the best ways we can help them is by managing our own anxiety and managing our own steps in the dance that contributes to ongoing anxiety. And so part of the emphasis in our book is how important it is for parents to move in the direction of being what we call a non-anxious presence. And that kids of any age benefit from parents who are not highly anxious and reactive, so that if a kid screws up, they aren't worried, oh my God, my parents are going to kill me,
mm-hmm.
where parents can be more thoughtful and helpful. So that it really is, there's so much that parents can do to help kids if they understand the rationale and understand what to do.
So Ned Johnson and Bill, of course, chime in, but how did parents get like this? What do we know about how these generations of parents turned into these micromanagers?
Well, it's not always perfectly clear, but one thing we know is that stress is contagious, right? So if I'm really anxious about something and literally sitting there in the same room with you, you're going to feel my stress. And so stressful people make other people stressful, and we can sort of just keep amping each other up one by one. Mm-hmm. It's also the case that in the last decades we've become increasingly thinking that there's this very narrow path to success, that only by being the top 10% of your class in school are you going to be go to good university and then have a good job and then have a good life and have a wonderful spouse and da da da. And of course it's just not true, and we talk about this quite a bit in our book, what we call alternate paths. But if you think about that as a model, you end up with, by definition, 90% of people can't be top 10%. Right, and so that 90% is either going to be desperate to get in there, or just why even bother trying? And even the people who are in the top 10%, they're not exactly doing a victory lap. I mean, they're terrified that they'll fall out of there. And then for parents, if we believe that, then we get incredibly stressed if we don't have a kid who's top 10%. And part of it, of course, is that our fears about today are really not about today; they're about the future. That if a kid is got a C plus now, seventh grade math, it's easy to extrapolate and picture my child's going to have a C-plus life, and I don't want that for her. I love her too much. I want her to have a wonderful life. And I suppose it's a little bit of the educational industrial complex where we've made it more and more the work of parents to do the work of children. And it's not the work of parents to do the work of children. It's the work of children to do the work of children. We have a story in the book where my son in fifth grade, his mom was helping him a little with his homework. And he says, and she asked him, why didn't you do whatever? Which is a perfectly reasonable question. And he kind of froze and turned and looked at her and said, because you didn't remind me. And I like hold up, and so I looked at him and said, "Look, pal. First of all, it's not your mom's fault. This is your work. Your work. It's fifth grade. First of all, she's already done fifth grade, so it's your opportunity." Mm-hmm. And two, I looked at her. I said, "Sweetheart, he has every reason to expect that you would remind him because you always have. So we just need to step back. We should be here to help him. We're a consultant, but we don't want to be on top of him all the time because it's an inaccurate model of the world." But your big question, if we have this idea that there's only the people who go to Ivy League schools to be successful, which is, of course, just not true, mm-hmm. it makes this sense of scarcity that's not based in reality, and it makes us all so anxious all the while. And what we're seeing, we're telling kids and parents, is that the most important work of adolescence is wiring the brain you're going to have for the rest of your life. And people go to very non-selective colleges and have fantastic lives. And more, we're seeing people going to the most selective universities in the country, and then they're flaming out and really incapacitated for years, if not decades, because of the anxiety and depression that they put themselves under. And they've wired a brain that is not going to be successful, in spite of, maybe because of, going to that most elite of universities.
You made reference to parents shouldn't be doing the work of children. Children should be doing the work of children. But I think, Bill Stixrud, you said earlier about this kid who's doing 6 hours of homework a night. I mean, there's a big disconnect here. The kids should not be doing 6 hours of homework a night. Any kid, that can't be what a child is expected to do. But apparently they are. And the parents have nothing to do with it.
And I'll just take 20 seconds and say I think I agree with everything that Ned said. I think the two other factors, the really important factors about why parents are so anxious now, is that we're all sleeping much less than we did 100 years ago or 50 years ago, and just being tired makes you more stressed. Mm-hmm. And secondly, technology is great in many ways, but it makes life go faster and it makes it more stressful. And there's a paper that came out last year that showed that dramatic spike in the incidence of depression and anxiety in the last 6 or 7 years, and the hypothesis is related to the cell phone and particularly to social media.
Right.
And we think is this kind of toxic culture where in education these decisions are being made for kids to take as many AP classes as they can. Colleges want you to take the hardest possible classes and as many as you can, and it's just part of this insane thinking about what's important. And what Ned and I value, it's all based in fear. It's based in fear that somehow the funnel for success is like their path is like this very narrow funnel, and only a few kids are going to get through it. And it's all, you have to be highly competitive. And it's completely and utterly untrue. And I think that the challenge, though, is the kids get into it, and it's hard to talk. Once kids are doing 6 hours of homework, it's hard to talk them out of it. And so I think that in our book, we have a chapter on motivation and talk about these really highly focused, really driven kids and how you can peel them off the wall a little bit and how you can help them get more in tune with their own values. Because most kids aren't superficial. Most kids, it's not, my highest value is prestige or fame. Mm-hmm. Most kids value things like integrity and my relationships. We try to get them more connected with what they really value, and then they can pull back a little bit and say, well, I probably don't need to take 5 EP classes. And if I don't go to Harvard, I probably could still have a pretty good life.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Bill Stixrud. He's a clinical neuropsychologist. He teaches at Children's National and the George Washington University School of Medicine. Also with us, Ned Johnson, founder and president of Prep Matters, a tutoring and test prep service. Together, they co-wrote the book, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about the social media thing, the cell phone, that kind of a thing. It's not going away. The social media issue, though, is a problem. There's been, you know, Black Mirror shows, other kinds of shows pointing to a really malevolent force when it comes to social media and how we see ourselves in it way too much now. Ned Johnson?
Yeah, no. I mean, one of the people I sort of currently have this crush on is this guy named Tristan Harris, who runs what's called the Center for Humane Technology, and he's sort of been all over the place, 60 Minutes and other things. And he's talked about, he used to be the chief ethicist for Google, and then he quit because he felt that what they were doing was not, in his mind, fully ethical. And he talks about how the current model of the internet is basically to grab your attention and hold on to it for as long as possible, and then sell that to whoever wants to put ads online. And so if your politics are left, you get all this sort of fear-mongering stuff. If your politics is right, all this fear-mongering stuff. If you're into flowers, you'll get constant pictures of flowers, whatever, whatever. My son, when he was in sixth grade, said, why am I getting all these pop-up ads about Legos? And I said, well, were you on Amazon? Yeah. Were you looking at Legos? Yeah. Well, let me explain to you how this works. And so I love this guy in part because he's young, he's incredibly articulate, and he talks in a very authentic way that I think really resonates with young people about kids. Teenagers have a real nose for hypocrisy. And they think that all these things are being done for them, but really it's being done to them just to make someone else be a billionaire. And so you really can't sit there and browbeat a kid and tell him this is terrible for him, and you just need to turn that thing off. We talk about how to sort of collaboratively work as families to set boundaries on how technology is used. And part of this is being empathetic. I know how addictive this is because it was designed that way. And it is important for you to connect with your friends, but here are the downsides to it. We have a whole chapter in our book talking about radical digital downtime, because the effects of technology, especially social media, it's so overwhelming to the mind, it's so fragmenting to the mind, it's so stressful to the mind, that we really need to take time to just step away from it for hours, if not days at a time. I had a student who, again, I do all this test prep, and she was taking her test, she had special accommodations, she was taking the test, her ACT, at school, at the end of the school day. And I was like, holy smokes, that's not great, because you're focused on 1,000 things just like you're online, and then you're going to have a hard time to sit down and really focus. And so I said, here's what I want you to do. She had a last period free. I said, I want you to take your cell phone, turn it off, lock it in your locker, go outside behind your school. I knew her school well. Mm-hmm. Behind the football stadium, there's a bunch of woods. And I want you to go out there and walk for 10 or 15 minutes and just think about nothing, away from your cell phone, please, 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 and then go and take your test. This will be almost like meditation, and it will clear your prefrontal cortex, and you'll take the test and you'll think more clearly. And her score went up 4 points. Now, we did a little bit of stuff, but a huge amount of it I attribute to the fact that we got her off of technology, so all those executive functions worked better, and she could focus more clearly and take care of the tasks that really mattered to her more.
Let's see, Trent in Columbus. Okay, I guess we'll have to wait for that call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org.
Here's Trent. Trent in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Trent.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Hey, I was just listening to the program and thought I'd give you a call. I've never done that. I love listening in, though.
Thanks.
I might have a relevant story. So when I was 14, I grew up in Vinton County, rural Ohio, public schools. I never had any tutoring at home or anything like that. I just had parents who always encouraged me to do really well in school, but they let me take ownership, unlike some of my friends whose parents would sift through their backpack to find out, what kind of homework was due the next day. My parents would just say, report to me with your report card. And as long as I produced results, they would back off, for a lack of better words, and let me do my thing, which I think was really so beneficial. So then fast forward to 98, we got a letter in the mail that I think is sent to a ton of students, if not every student at a public school in the state. It just said, there's a meeting at the high school about post-secondary enrollment option programs where you can take some college courses during high school. So I said, Mom, let's go check this out. And they said, hey, I raised my hand during the meeting and I asked, are we able to do it full time? And they said, well, nobody's done that. But actually this year, it's something that is allowed now under, I think it was Senate Bill 140, permitted freshmen in high school to take all their courses at a college. So I was able to go directly from eighth grade under Vinton County Public Schools to a full-time college student, and it was a life-altering, amazing experience. And I never stepped foot in high school, but I still went to homecoming and ran cross-country for Vinton County High School, and there was a lot of commuting and catching rides because I wasn't old enough to drive, or I had braces, and when I was in my OTEM and juniors English courses, but it was an amazing experience nonetheless.
I asked my screener to check to see if you were a gifted student, and you said you weren't. I mean, we usually
definitely
think of
not.
14-year-olds in college as, kind of freaks or something.
Isn't it so interesting?
Yeah, yeah. You seem real normal.
I got that. We were invited. I just had to take a couple tests to get in, and truly, and it's just a matter of how we foster our children, how we raise them, and my parents just said, "Go for it, why not?"
But it was your choice.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I organized my transportation. I got my homework done in kindergarten. I got my homework done in college, and I got a 4.0 that first quarter.
Oh my gosh!
Because and here's the thing, I also got my first C in life that next quarter, and I got so many valuable lessons. But I was set up to take ownership. And so when I didn't do well, I didn't, like the other caller was explaining, I didn't blame my parents. I didn't blame the teachers. I just looked in the mirror. So I think, if anything, I hope a lot of people are listening and they're considering how to encourage their children just to take ownership and show your children that you believe in them. But it's okay if you get a bad grade. It's not the end of the world.
Right.
So anyway, I'm done rambling.
Well, thank you,
sorry.
Trent. That's okay. Yeah. Thanks for calling. I appreciate that. Thanks for listening. He's sort of from your textbook, Bill and Ned.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful because it was so many of the kids that Ned and I work with that have a very difficult relationship with their parents because they feel so much pressure from their parents. They feel so much pressure to achieve at a high level. And one of the things we talk about in our book is something called self-determination theory that holds that human beings have three basic needs, one for a sense of autonomy, for a sense of relatedness and for a sense of competence. And we make the point that so often that what happens is that parents focus on competence so much that it interferes with that relatedness. What I love about what Trent said was that it sounds like his parents were so supportive that he probably had a very positive relationship with his parents mm-hmm. while he was making these decisions. And we see it, these kids are doing 6 hours a night. They're taking they're 10th grade or 11th grade. They're taking 5 college courses, and it's all complete struggle. And what I love about what Trent said, he felt, I'm ready to do this. I want to take on this challenge. And Ned refers to the way many of his clients, the kids he works with per school, is kind of station by station. Denise Pope Clark wrote a book called Doing School, where kids taking all these AP classes is just jumping through hoops. Mm-hmm. And just contrast that with what Trent just said is so profound. Mm-hmm.
We'll continue our conversation. That's Bill Stixrud. He's a clinical neuropsychologist. He teaches at Children's National and the George Washington University School of Medicine. Also, Ned Johnson, founder and president of Prep Matters, a tutoring and test prep service. They're co-authors of the book, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org for questions or comments. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We talk about how parents can learn to trust their kids' choices and why that's a benefit. Still with us are co-authors of The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives, founder and president of Prep Matters, Ned Johnson, and also clinical neuropsychologist William Stixrud. I wanted to get to an email right away, Bill and Ned. It's from Julie, and she asks, is it ever too late? My kids are 18 and almost 15. This resonates so much, but I'm afraid it's too late.
We think it's never too late. I mean, in part because, you know, when we first titled this, I wanted to call it The Self-Driven Kid. And our sage editor said, well, I'm no longer a kid, but I'm still my mother's child. And in addition to, you know, the forming the brain, and again, it's not fully baked until 25 cognitively and probably 30 emotionally, we're also talking about a way of parenting that's about developing relations, you know, relationships between us as parents and our kids. And, you know, your writer is going to have the relationship with her kids for the rest of her life. And if there are things that she can do that are incrementally better, that will be better for her and for her kids, and it's also going to be better for the relationship. And because we want as parents, and we want to help parents support their kids so that their children feel like things are being done for them, not to them, because it just makes everything more successful and it makes everyone happier.
Yeah. And I'd add that nobody needs perfect parents. And certainly once kids are grown up, that they have all manner of ways in which they can craft their own life. And there's one of the most powerful things in the book, in my opinion, is there's a letter from a mother who trusted her kid, supported her kid, but at one point felt that the decisions were too important. The mother basically overrode the kid and said, you're going to do it my way. And the letter is an apology to the kid for not trusting her and said, I'm never going to do that again. It's a very beautiful and moving letter. And I remember, I'm not young, but I remember some of the most powerful experiences of my childhood was my father's apologizing to me. Mm-hmm. If he got mad at me about it, he was critical about something. And I think that if you read the book and you think, God, I could have done things differently, just tell your kid, I'm reading this stuff and I realize that if I could do this differently, I probably would, but you're incredible the way you are. And I just want you to know that I have great confidence in you.
Keith in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Keith.
Hi. I'm calling as a retired public school educator and having raised a child who was a special needs child. And basically a question has to do with how standardized testing has come about in the state of Ohio and across the country has changed how parents parent, how, you know, students' perceptions of success in school has changed and evolved during the last 25 or 30 years and has increased levels of anxiety.
It's a great question. My feeling is that it's certainly changed it for the worse. I mean, you know, we do, again, sort of think about the educational industrial complex, that I doubt there are a whole bunch of school teachers who say, what we really need for me to be a better English teacher, I need more standardized tests to assess how my students are doing. Or, well, gosh, if only I had a ton more technology in here, somehow that would help us, you know, read Great Gatsby better. And both of these things, they accelerate the pace of things and they externalize the focus, the locus of control. What every kid should be focused on and what every parent is trying to be focused on and certainly what every teacher is focused on is helping children develop. And standardized tests, by their nature, externalize the attention locus of control. They start paying attention to you, but how am I doing compared to everyone else? And it's a road to ruin. What we really should be doing is saying, what are the tools that help kids and their parents and their teachers focus on how the kid is developing relative to his own benchmarks? Because no matter where you are, whether you really struggle or whether you're at the top of the heap, you're just trying to get better. And whatever it is that matters to you. And so if I could wave a magic wand, you know, standardized tests would if they weren't completely eliminated, they would be deeply, deeply curtailed in their current use. And I say this as a guy who's a test prep geek.
Yeah, you are. I mean, that's what you do.
And I test kids for a living. I mean, I make a living by testing kids and finding out what they can do and what they can't do. And there's a chapter in our book. It's called Taking a Sense of Control to School, and which we talk about testing. We talk about the value of classroom tests that actually measure what kids are learning from their curriculum. Because when you prepare for a test or you're tested, you actually learn better as opposed to the way standardized tests are used. And one of the things we say in the book is that from our perspective, all the innovations in education, all the reforms that have been made, at least the last 30 years, have been completely uninformed by knowledge of the brain. So that if you know anything about the brain and what stress does to learning, anything that makes school more stressful for kids, their parents, their teachers, their administrators, it's going to be counterproductive because the brain doesn't learn well when it's stressed. And from my perspective, the level of stress that kids experience and that teachers experience and parents experience regarding these standardized tests is ridiculous and just counterproductive.
Keith, thanks a lot for that call. Elizabeth in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I am an eighth grade teacher turned educational psychologist, and now I actually teach pre-service teachers kind of all of the stuff that your speakers are talking about. And one of the things that we study a lot in my field is how much of a drop in achievement and motivation and overall well-being and happiness students tend to experience when they go into middle school. And of course, there's the thought that maybe it's because middle school tends to be so much less autonomy supportive than elementary school does. And so students' basic needs, that need for autonomy and relatedness and competence, aren't being met well. And so one of my fears is that once I have kids in the school system, how I can support them when they're in a school system that's not supporting those needs and not providing them autonomy and not giving them chances to kind of spread their wings. And so I wondered what your speakers had to say about that.
Yeah, go ahead. Ned?
Billy, you want to jump in? I got it.
Well, so what I would say is that I mean, I came out of a school psych program myself and never worked in schools, but I'm in schools a lot. And I think that certainly middle school, I mean, that, you know, I tested a kid once who's having troubles in eighth grader, and the dad broke into tears and said, "This should be the happiest time of his life." And I said, "Well, obviously you skipped eighth grade." And middle school is hard for kids. There's so much going on. But you're absolutely right that sense of control or autonomy lowers every year of kids in school. And when kids are hard to manage or kids aren't doing well, our first impulse is to crack down on them. When actually what they need in most cases is more autonomy. And the problem that you're raising is a difficult one. I think that most of these things, whether it's technology or sleep or this lack of autonomy, that the kids increasing lack of autonomy, we're going to have to solve them as a community of professionals in private practice, of parents, of teachers, administrators, because we can't solve them as individuals. But I do think, and teachers experience increasingly low a sense of autonomy or control over the classrooms as they're giving scripted curriculum and teaching to the test. Mm-hmm. So it's a big challenge, I think, that we need to work on as communities and as a school psychologist. I mean, that where we can, we want to let teachers know that anytime they can give kids choice about how to do things, anytime they can tell kids a little bit about their brain, about how individual difference in brains, anytime that teachers seek feedback, was this assignment helpful to you? Mm-hmm. What do you think is the best way to learn this? Any way that teachers can build in autonomy for students will really help.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for that call. Adam in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love your show.
Thank you.
My comment is, I grew up in a bedroom community, Pickerington Public Schools. When I was kindergarten, first, second grade, I was in reading comprehension class because I was behind my peers. I had a stuttering problem I had to work through, and people really didn't expect me to really have a bolsterous career, as I guess you can say. Through high school, 4.0 student, took some AP classes, graduated with a 4.0 in high school, but took 5 AP classes and got 3s on all of them. Went to Ohio State, had aspirations to go to medical school, under neuroscience undergrad, worked in a neuropsychology testing lab, so I appreciate your work, Dr. William there.
Yeah.
Because I graduated OSU with a 3.0, I really didn't have the medical school aspirations anymore. You really can't do much with that. Well, I decided to go to graduate school and really focus on another aspect that I love, which was emergency management. And here we are 5 years later. I graduated OSU, and I finished 3 masters, and I'm working towards a PhD now.
My gosh.
Good for you.
Well, thank you. My question towards it was all this stress that was in college was more, I understood this is on me and this is what I need to do, but I guess I just didn't perceive the way how this is going to affect my life, if that makes sense. And it wasn't really until I got rid of this, I have to get into medical school stress, that I really started to excel in all my masters. I graduated summa cum laude from 3 different master's programs.
Wow.
And it wasn't because I had this, I have to do this, I have to do this, just because I enjoy doing this. Right. I love it. I don't have this stress of what is my life going to be if I don't finish this.
Gosh, another textbook example. Adam, thank you so much. We're running out of time,
yeah.
but I wow.
Yeah, really quickly, I mean, the same Sonia Luthien who gave us the NUTS model talks about one of the most helpful things to lower stress, and certainly in your caller's story here, and but also for us as parents and for kids, is to have a plan B, that if this doesn't work out, there's something else that I can do, because it lowers the stress so much. And in my experience helping kids with these ridiculous tests, even knowing that if you don't get the score, here's another way you can still go on and be successful in college and in life, lowers the stress and makes it more likely that they will perform their best and actually be successful in their plan A.
I want to thank you both for joining us today. Ned Johnson, founder and president of Prep Matters, tutoring and test prep service, and also Bill Stixrud, a clinical neuropsychologist. Thanks to you both. I appreciate your time.
Great. Thanks for having us.
William Stixrud and Ned Johnson are co-authors of the book, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. I want to thank the All Sides staff. producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, our All Sides interns Michael Lee, Alexander Havalchik, and Martin Coleman, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides, and follow me on Twitter too at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.